friends. Welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. If you're in the States, I hope that you had a wonderful, relaxing, feast-filled Thanksgiving holiday. And now here we are, almost at December, ready to play out, to ride out the remainder of 2018. Hey, we're on streaming platforms too. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Podcast, TuneIn, iHeart Radio, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, we would so love it and appreciate it if you can give us some stars, show us some love so we can get higher up in the rankings, because we are all about talking to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music industry today, so you guys can find out exactly how they got their music jobs. What decisions did they make? What paths did they choose? What obstacles did they face? And also, if you're an artist, a musician, just a lot of great insight and experience about exactly how to navigate the music industry landscape today, as it is the Wild West at times. So last episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Jeff Weiss. He is a writer. He's a journalist. He is definitely an integral part of LA's culture landscape. And he is the founder of Passion of the Weiss, which is an online music magazine, and the soon-to-be-released The Land magazine, an LA cultural magazine. So just a lot of great insight. And also, you know, if you're a writer, just a lot of great ideas about how to get a writing gig, how to become a music writer. So really good stuff. Go on back and listen to it if you haven't already. So my next guest is Lisa Husseini. She is the now official CEO of iCadenza, and she is going to walk us through her incredible career trajectory and her music career. But before we do that, you know, I always love to start with a favorite track. So here is Lisa's favorite track. It's Earthquake by Wishlist. Here we go.
Pick me up when this is done. Give everything I have, but I got no one. I can feel time running out, but I'm racing for the finish line. Just another face, I'm sure that you'll erase. But that's okay, I'm doing me and I prefer the space. Got a lot of things I'm trying to do.
Welcome to Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job?
Hey, Elle Ariel, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So I always start off with asking, we go way back to childhood. Tell me about your first music memories. What was going on when you were growing up?
Totally. So I'm actually the child of two engineers with no formal music training. I don't know if my father ever listens to music, and my mother, she's self-taught guitar growing up, you know, in her bedroom, listening along to rock albums. But so my first musical memory in terms of like me realizing that music was something that didn't just come out of the radio was in elementary school when we picked up recorders. It was my second and third grade music teacher, when we were in that class, where I realized, oh my gosh, this is something that people do. This is something that people experience together. Then, of course, like fourth grade band and picking an instrument and all of that. And everything just kind of snowballed from there.
That's so cool. So you were just like, this is it. Like, this is what I found my joy kind of thing.
A little bit. So it was actually a little more self-centered than that. In the fourth grade, I picked the flute, and you know, people always ask when you play an instrument, why did you choose that instrument? What led you to choose it? I wish I could give a profound answer, but in all honesty, my mom wanted me to play any other instrument but the flute.
Oh, funny.
She was convinced. She was like, you know, it's what all of the girls wanted to play. And she was like, you just want to play it because you want to do what everybody else is doing. You should play the clarinet. You should play this, that, the other thing. And so I gave her a choice. I was like, I'll play the saxophone, which was the most expensive instrument, so I knew that she wouldn't choose it, or I'll play the flute. And so she caved and she rented me a flute. So that's why I chose it, a snarky little fourth grader trying to stick it to my mom. Then in the fifth grade, the teacher was like, you know, she's really talented. You should get her lessons. And there was nothing that fifth grade me loved more than hearing I was good at something. Aww. And so that pushed me to practice. And from then on, I knew that was what I wanted to do.
So you started taking lessons, and was it a case of like, even through high school, you were like, I'm going to go to music school. Like, walk us through that.
Yeah. So I grew up in a town called Stoughton, just outside of Boston. My mother, while she wasn't a classically trained musician, she knew enough to know that, you know, living near a city like Boston provided us with resources that were available. So in the fifth grade, I had started taking private lessons with my band teacher at the time, just after school, informally. But around the seventh grade, my mom took me to the Boston Symphony Orchestra, had an open day in conjunction with New England Conservatory, which is just down the street. And it was like this block party type of thing. I don't remember much, but I remember that there were five French horns playing on the steps of New England Conservatory. I remember that very vividly. And we just kind of walked around and experienced the instrument petting zoo and meeting all of these people. From my mom had asked me if I liked it, and I said yes. And so I auditioned for lessons, private lessons through NEC Prep, and also for their wind ensemble. And I was totally shocked when I got in. It was like, I didn't even think that that was something that I was even nearly qualified for. And so in the eighth grade, I started with their youth wind ensemble, actually their junior one. They call it MIWI. I started with private flute lessons, then through NEC Prep. And for anybody who's gone to like a formalized prep school, so like Juilliard Prep or NEC Prep in terms of music education, if you are willing to jump on that track, which I very, very much was, there's a very clear track for you, especially for a classical orchestral musician. So I totally drank that Kool-Aid, did every youth orchestra, every wind ensemble I could do, took all of my private lessons through there, and totally immersed myself in that community.
I think that's phenomenal. And we talked about before the interview, we're both from Boston, and I was doing classical piano. And I remember like going to the BSO Saturday mornings. They'd have basically like kids concerts or like music, classical music specifically geared towards kids. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just felt like it was a very supportive community in that sense. And obviously like 4th of July, you know, the Esplanade and the Boston Pops. And so there was this very sort of like healthy, vibrant classical community. I wonder if you can speak a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's so funny because I went on then to get my graduate degree at New England Conservatory. I came back for my graduate degree, and then I worked for a couple of years at New England Conservatory Preparatory School, where I had done my high school and middle school studies. And so for me, it very much is talking about home. And the Boston musical community that I say I immerse myself in, so there are, I think there are now so many more prep programs there. But at the time I was that age, there was really two. One through Boston University, the Greater Boston Youth Symphony Orchestras, and the NEC Prep program. And through that, you had teachers who were in the Boston Symphony, who were freelancers in all the major orchestras there. My flute teacher at the time was, you know, one of the main flute freelancers, and I remember going to concerts of hers after orchestra practice, and just, you know, you get, it's a sense of belonging that is really special for a high schooler, especially because the high school community that I was brought up in, about 10 years before our orchestral program had been cut, there was a huge round of budget cuts in Massachusetts that led to the cut of many orchestra programs across the state. Mm-hmm. And my school district was one of those. And there were a lot of musically talented people who had come out of my school, but it wasn't the primary focus. And for me to then go into Boston, it was basically Friday afternoon through Sunday evening. My world became this place where, you know, you could be in a rehearsal and then a graduate student from New England Conservatory who was studying with one of the Boston Symphony flute players would pull us aside for a sectional. And it's like you got a window into what their life was like. It was almost like these magical creatures. You saw what your future could be. And it was just, it was so supportive, as you said. Boston is a really supportive place because there's so many arts to be had. It's not like there is no room for everyone to rise together. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was like the world got smaller in a very awesome and inclusive way. And I think it led to a lot of feelings of like empowerment, not just musically, but for my sense of self growing up in high school in that community.
Yeah, I like that. That's a great explanation of what was there and what was available to people like you, like artists like you. So you're at NEC, so you go on to NEC. It's sort of like you've got your clear track. And then were you basically like, I'm going to be, you know, working for an orchestra. Like, I'm just going to see what orchestra I'm basically going to be picked up.
Yeah, so my road, this is where things start getting really bumpy. So like at this point, you know, all through NEC prep, I was like, this is amazing. I can do anything. I was big fish, small pond in my school. And there were a few people at NEC prep who were ahead of me in terms of talent. But, you know, I felt like the next step was I would go to a school like NEC or Juilliard. And I think this is common nowadays, but back then it wasn't common for everybody, definitely for conservatory prep kids it was. I applied to 13 music schools my senior year, and like all of the top ones, you know, Juilliard, Eastman, NEC. And I had applied to the Hart School of Music in Hartford, Connecticut, and I don't even know why, but I knew it was my safety school. And I got rejected from every school except for the Hart School. And I was so devastated. But the thing was, the Hart School really wanted me. And I got like a huge scholarship. But, you know, as a high schooler who had just been rejected from what they thought was the path to their dream, I was a little persnickety about it. Persnickety? I don't know what the word is, but I was that. And many more things. But so I went to Hart, and within a few weeks, I was like, okay, the teacher here, my teacher at the time had been there for many, many years. I was like, okay, great. You know, I belong here. This is going to be a place where I can really dig in and achieve that goal of getting into the grad school of my dreams. Because with classical musicians, it's understood that you're going to go straight to grad school. So I felt like I had a little more leeway. But then at the end of my freshman year, my flute teacher retired. And I stayed on and studied with another flute teacher who was there, who's now the main flute teacher there. She's great. But it was a type of thing where, you know, you go to school in conservatories, or the way conservatories are set up, most of them, is you go to school to study with a specific teacher. When that teacher leaves, it kind of rattles your world. And I don't know, like, where her teaching was and where I was in that stage of my life, we weren't the best fit necessarily. That really messed with me. Like, as a sophomore and junior in college, I felt like there was something wrong with me, and I almost gave up music entirely.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really hard. And I one day walked into the study abroad office at the University of Hartford, which Hart students had been told was off limits to them. But I just kind of was like, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I walked into the office and I said, do you have any options for Hart students? And they said, yes, we have two. You can go to Vienna or you can go to Amsterdam. In Vienna, you're in a program with other American students. In Amsterdam, we just kind of stick you in the conservatory. And I knew nothing about Amsterdam. And actually, I was such a self-shelterer. I really only focused on school. I didn't even know any of the like wild connotations that Amsterdam held. I had no idea what this place was. But I was like, I like the idea of being in a conservatory. That totally is not the school I'm in now. Not being with American students. I'll do that. I'll go there. And my semester in Amsterdam changed and revived my musical career in a way that I mean, those 6 months were just so valuable to me. My teacher there was so giving. The way he looked at things was so unique. And the musical environment in Amsterdam was so focused on creativity, support, branching out, doing the unusual, and so not focused on perfection, which the American classical system very much is, especially during the conservatory years. It was like I stepped into this land where I felt I was coming in and being like, how much can I fix in 6 months? And they were standing there being like, how much can you create in these 6 months?
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was like a very defining moment. I came back, finished out Hart, and I only wanted one thing in graduate school. I wanted to go to New England Conservatory, and I wanted to study with Fenwick Smith, who was at that time the second flutist in the Boston Symphony, or he had just retired. He was the first flutist I had ever heard, and just a legend in the field. And I got in. I studied with him for 2 years, but halfway through my graduate degree, I had this moment where I questioned everything and totally changed my career course at that moment, which I can tell you about if you want to hear about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. This is what it's all about.
Cool. Yeah. So my second year of graduate school, at this point, I had taken a few auditions, a few professional auditions. I wanted to be in an orchestra. I wanted to be a second flute player in an orchestra. And I had taken a few auditions and I had advanced to semis and a couple, you know, otherwise wasn't very successful. And I was standing both probably in this practice room at NEC on the second floor. It was right by the stairwell. I remember this like it was yesterday. And I was practicing this excerpt from classical symphony that flutists, if anybody's ever lived anywhere within like 50 yards of a flutist, they've heard this played and practiced. It is mind-numbingly high and annoying. So I was practicing it at like a quarter of the speed, trying to achieve a level of perfection that is just not what music's about. Mm. And so I start having this thought that is like getting louder, that is saying, this is not making you happy anymore. And so I did what any musician or anybody who has ever questioned the thing that they held their identity in for decades, I immediately tried to shove that thought back inside. I was like, yeah. Oh, wait, stop that. Mm-hmm. You don't belong here. You don't know what you're talking about. But the thought wouldn't go away. And I totally lost it, like had a full-on meltdown in this practice room. And my friend walked by the practice room, saw me in the window, and I was like, I need to tell you this awful thing that just happened. I don't know if being a performer is what I want to do. Why do I feel this way? You know, I kept asking him, why me? Like, why do none of the other flutists feel this way? Why is this happening to me? And he's still a very close friend of mine. He's one of the wisest people I know. He was like, listen, you have so many strengths. Maybe the reason you are feeling this and allowing yourself to have this thought is because deep down you know that you have a ton of tools that you can use to build the future you want. Whereas there are other people who don't necessarily have that, for whom pursuing flute is their only option, or who just haven't allowed themselves to think that yet. So take this as an opportunity to really think about, what skills am I neglecting to bring into the picture that are causing me to have this kind of like rebellious reaction to performing? And so he was right. You know, he's, like I said, he's incredibly smart. And at the time I had my first work study job, I was the manager of a youth orchestra through NAC Prep about like 10 or 15 hours a week. And I was sitting in the office thinking about what this friend had said to me, and it dawned on me that I had always had this fascination with business and management. And actually, when I was a senior in high school, I applied for about 5 business management schools, and I got into all of them, which, as you'll notice, didn't occur in the story about me getting into schools, because at that time, all I cared about was flute. Right. But somewhere deep down inside, I knew that there was something about management that was really cool to me, about how people, like, there were skills behind managing people. So in this job, I was thinking, you know, I'm never going to be James Galway. Like, I'm never going to be the flutist who changes the face of flute. And this I knew. I was like, you know, best case scenario, I would have a career that ideally would make me happy, but it's not like I'm going to change anything. But I was like, what do I want? I want to make an impact in the arts. And I think I might be able to do that more in the administrative field. I wasn't sure at the time how I would do that. I wasn't exactly sure what my skills were or were not. And that took about 10 years to really hone in on. But I had a feeling that it would be administrative. And I had a feeling that whatever job was out there for me did not yet exist. Of this, I was very, very certain. And when people would ask me, like, what do you want to do now that you've decided you want to do administration? I would tell them that, and they would be like, Lisa, you need to sleep more. Like, you're crazy. You've gone off the deep end. Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, I don't know how to explain it. I just know that whatever is out there for me, it doesn't exist yet. And I was totally right. So I did get enough sleep.
Yeah. Now, did you leave the master's program, or what happened?
So I actually didn't. I stayed, and at that point, I was about halfway through, a little more than halfway through. So, you know, NAC is such a great school, and their graduate program is really quite awesome. They're basically like, here, have credits, use them. Like, they don't really, for graduate students, they don't really have many restrictions on what you need to study, which is awesome, because I basically spent the last 2 semesters taking really cool classes like the history of Jewish music, which was basically like us improvising on a new type of Jewish music every week with one of the most prominent Jewish musicians in Boston. So I just, like, my time at NAC was filled with performance joy. And also, I threw myself into my work-study job as the orchestra manager. I took on another ensemble. I managed 2 orchestras at the time. And I really tried to learn everything I possibly could from the staff that was around me. And I, at the time, also took an internship with From the Top, which was just across the street, helping them with their gala. And so I just tried to jam in as much as I possibly could to this degree I was already getting, because I figured having a degree from New England Conservatory in the arts administration world carries, fortunately for me, but unfortunately for arts administration sometimes, having a degree from these elite conservatories carries like a very heavy weight when applying for arts administration jobs. I have mixed feelings on it, because obviously it worked out for me, but at the same time, I know opportunities were given to me because of that, when I'm like, I learned nothing that would actually help me in this job at that school for my degree. So it's a little weird, but I was aware of that at the time. So I was like, I'm going to finish this degree and get this piece of paper that I know will bring me value. And at the same time, I'm going to suck as much information as I can out of this institution.
Did you find any resistance to the fact that you were like, I'm really not going to be pursuing a performance career or utilizing a performance degree in the manner in which it's supposed to be used? Like, what was the reaction?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I didn't really expect, or I didn't really get as much resistance as I expected. The person I most had the resistance from was myself. The second most resistance-based category of people were some of my peers who at that time saw what's very common, I think, for musicians on the trajectory up through the classical system. They saw arts administration as like a failure, like a fallback or whatever.
Right.
However, there were some peers of mine, and in fact, the three other flutists in my year at NEC were so supportive. And one of them said something to me that stuck with me, which when I told her what I had decided, she was like, well, of course, you know, she was like, you always just know what's going on. And she's like, I don't know how to explain it, but I know that if I don't know what's going on, I can come to you and like, you'll know what's happening with music, with schedules, whatever. She's like, so it makes perfect sense. Like that, totally. And I felt so validated by that, to have this peer who I had admired through our 2 years of school together, for her to be like, yeah, like that's your strength. Of course you're going to do that. So much, with so much conviction that I didn't have internally. But other than that, I was lucky. I didn't experience much resistance. I think a lot of that had to do with my teacher, who, first of all, he was a great guy. He's since passed away, but you know, he was one of the most respected figures in Boston music because he was just so humble, and he showed up for his students in a way that he was there to teach. So it didn't really matter to him. Like, he had no pride or ego resting on my career as a flutist. His big concern was teaching me. And at that time, he also, he was ill in the years leading up to his death. And at that time, he had started to become ill. So I think for him, it was really just, he would be there for my lessons and give me the support he needed, that I needed musically. But he also was a flute maker himself. He built his own house in Tanglewood. He bought a Masonic lodge and built a recording studio in it, and then sold that recording studio and still managed it on the side. So he was an entrepreneur himself. And I think even if he was well and like lucid through our time together, he would have been all for it.
That's a great point. And I love hearing that, because I think sort of the stereotypical would be like, you know, everyone's like, how dare you, you know, but I love that now it's like people understand it and people get it. And I think also too, the fact that it wasn't like your parents pressuring you. It wasn't other people pressuring you to become a flutist. It was your own will and your own decision. So therefore it makes perfect sense that you alone would make the decision ultimately to leave that. You know what I mean?
Totally. But I do want to acknowledge that, you know, something that I now face with, I mean, a lot of my friends, but a lot of our clients, is just to say, like, do not underestimate the power of internal expectations and how they can show up as projections onto the people in your life. Because I don't remember much from that time other than feeling like I'd let everybody down. Everybody being, you know, the vague everybody.
Right.
Like, everybody at school has a new cell phone, or like, everybody is doing this, everybody's going to that party, like a non-defined everybody. But it was all me. It was all my internal expectations and pressures. So that can be sometimes worse until you figure it out. And then you're like, oh, it was just me all along.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. Yeah, absolutely. The committee, the internal committee.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah,
totally. So walk us through now post-graduation. So what was your career trajectory looking like?
Yeah, so this is a fun misconception of arts administration. One thing is I think people think that arts administration is like a solid job, especially musicians, right? Like, because a musician's future isn't that certain. And they look at arts administration, they say, oh, at least there's a structure, there's certainty there. But it's not. And also oftentimes in nonprofit institutions, the dysfunction on the artistic side, you know, any spats or emotions that bubble up are mirrored like tenfold on the administrative side. So my administrative career, I've worked at a lot of really great institutions, and it's not to say that like the places I worked were awful. They weren't, they're great. But I definitely, until recently, I definitely had a feeling at each place. It was kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, where I'd have a job and I'd be like, oh, like this does not fit well. And there would always be a few reasons that had to do with my style and the institution. So I'll explain a little more. So right after college, I was so lucky. There were huge internal shifts at NEC Prep in the staff. Mm-hmm. My boss at the time was promoted to director. And as a result, her staff position as the manager of all large ensembles at NEC Prep, which there are 26, or there were at the time, I think there are more now, there are 26 large ensembles at NEC Prep, like choruses, bands, jazz bands, everything, you name it. And so I stepped into that position. They Wow. hired me, and that was a wild, wild ride. I managed 12 work-study students, most of whom had just been my peers. The department itself now has, I think, 3 people to do the job that I did. It was a time of transition, and I remember I was like always stressed out. I worked so many hours. I would be embarrassed to even admit it. I basically breathed and slept and ate the NEC Prep job. But mm-hmm. I got so much experience. For anybody who ever wants like a crash course in administrative work, I recommend with extreme caution that you work in a job where you're in administration and you have to deal with parents.
Mm.
Because let me tell you, like any stress that pops up in a regular administrative setting, to have angry parents on the other end of it, it makes it a whole new league of pressure, learning, and being on it. So that was my first job. And I, in all honesty, I think I just reached a point where I'd burnt out, and I knew I needed to look for something. So I offhand one night at like my boyfriend at the time's house. So we were all at his place like for a football game, but I'm not so much into the sports. And I was like sitting on my laptop in the corner of the room while everybody's cheering. And I saw this job at New World Symphony in Miami, and it was overseeing their visiting faculty. So New World Symphony, for those who aren't familiar, is a fellowship driven orchestra based out of Miami. People go there after they get degrees, and it's a 3-year program. It's basically like, it's a fellowship program. It's a place for people to really hone their skills and get that orchestral job. But while they're there, they bring in top orchestral players from around America, and also leadership coaches. They bring in wellness coaches. They bring in communication coaches. They really give these fellows a well-rounded education. And so this job was managing that. And I applied on a whim, which I now never advise anybody to do. I always advise finding a connection. I don't know why they called me back for an interview. Usually that doesn't work, just a disclaimer, but they did. And in the interview process, I found out I had some connections with some of the people there. And so I think that helped. But I got the job. I had never been to Miami before. I just took the leap. I knew this was the next step for me. to be out of the Boston scene and to experience an institution that just was so different than anything I had experienced. Like at that time, the building was 20 years old, not even. Everything was just so fresh and new and technologically savvy. Meanwhile, Boston is very like brick and mortar, tradition, tradition.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So I moved to Miami for the job. I moved in January. I think it was 10 degrees when I left Boston. They were going through a cold spell in Miami. It was 65 degrees here. Everybody had winter jackets on and I was like sweating profusely because it was, and you live in California, so you know, right? Like,
yeah,
it's a shock. And I finally got used to it. When it's 70 now, I pull out the jacket like a good Miamian, but I moved down here, worked at New World. And New World was a totally different ball game because the parents went away, which was great for me at the time. But my job really touched on different areas of the institution in a way that allowed me to see so many different ways of working. I think I had one supervisor, but I really reported to three or four people at any given point. I worked on admissions and I worked on this training program. I worked with the main person who coaches the fellows on their performances, their chamber performances. And that was for me the first time I saw how a large arts organization works from the top to the bottom and back up to the top. Mm-hmm. And after about 2 years in that machine of a place, I mean, they run like clockwork. It's an extraordinary organization that many of my friends still work there. I realized that working within the system of a large arts organization was not for me, for the reason, mm-hmm. for many of the same reasons, I decided that trying to get an orchestral job as a performer was not for me. You know, the larger the organization, and this goes for the musicians too, I think with like the tenure process and everything, the larger an organization, the more bureaucracy that's built in automatically. And New World had the least amount of the big organizations that you see, and even that was too intolerable for me. So after that, I decided, okay, I'm going to go for a small organization. Ended up working for 2 years as general manager of a chamber chorus based out of Miami as well, Seraphic Fire. That was my first fully professional experience with professional musicians. Again, great organization, but after 2 years there, what I realized is, oh, it's not the size of the nonprofit. It's really just working in this mentality where everything just feels so out of reach. Like if we could just get more donors, or if we could just get a new building, or, you know, if we could just get new systems, if we had more money, if we had more time, in this place of always giving, 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 and not really feeling like you have the authority to press the reset button because you feel like you're serving so many masters. It's a mentality so many nonprofits have for good reason. I mean, there are many reasons that they feel that way. But for me, it was just very, very stifling. I have a lot of opinions and I like to make decisions. At this time, I had been working for iCadenza part-time for about 2.5 years. I had started working for them part-time while I was at New World, like 5 hours a week. And it was time for me to say goodbye to Seraphic Fire, and iCadenza really needed a full-time consultant on the team. And so I switched into that role, and I've been full-time on the team now for about 6 months. And actually tonight, I assume you're not releasing this podcast like immediately within the next few hours.
No.
So tonight, which will be later, you know, if this is released, tonight we're putting out an announcement. I'm now serving as the interim CEO. Tonight it's going to be announced that I'll be stepping into the role of CEO permanently.
Yay! That's awesome. So I'm going to just take credit, even though this will come out. I'm going to be like, this is the world premiere.
Exactly. Well, it will be. Yeah. So it's fresh off the presses.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. And I honestly can say, like, to anybody out there who is trying to figure out where they fit in their career, like if they're a performer, if they feel like this orchestra isn't what I thought it would be, will there ever be an orchestra where I fit? Will there ever be a piecing together of a career, freelance work that will fit? Will there ever be a place where I feel like my career fits? And especially if the people around you are saying, oh no, that doesn't exist, keep looking, like keep trying, keep looking, because I found in iCadenza, and even though I've only been full-time for a little bit, you know, I've been a part of the company for the past 2.5 years, and I found in iCadenza essentially everything, like I found my shared values and what I was really looking for in a work environment. In the company, and the company is 9 years old. So at the time that I was saying to everybody, the position I want doesn't exist yet, I was right. The company hadn't been founded yet. Yeah, I will scream it from the mountaintops probably until the day I die. Like, I can't tell you how many times people told me along the way, like, what you are looking for does not exist. That mindset does not exist. You have to accept that you're going to have to play the political game. You're going to have to accept that you'll be miserable in a job for 10 years before you can get to a job you're happy in. And if I had listened to them, I would be sitting in an office somewhere, probably very, very miserable and unhappy and burnt out. So.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, we're running short on time, and I want to talk about iCadenza. So can you just tell our listeners what iCadenza is all about?
So iCadenza is a consulting firm that was founded by two women, Jennifer Rosenfeld and Julia Torgovitskaya Rapoport. They were friends in middle school, went to different colleges, and long story short, had this idea that they wanted to help musicians have their dream careers and put forth a business plan in this business plan competition at Julia's college. And they got like second place, won $5,000. And iCadenza was formed. Out of iCadenza, Cadenza Artists, our sister company and artist agency, was formed a few years later. And basically what iCadenza has done over the years and what we do now, as we're really going back to our roots of why the company was founded, is we work with musicians at all stages in their career. Typically our work starts at the conservatory level. We have products that serve this crowd, and we also do workshops and visit universities. We have individual clients who are at what would outsiders would consider the peak of their careers, but they're feeling unfulfilled or unsure of a new project they want to launch. We also work with musicians along that journey, and we have a series of different products and also coaching offerings that we offer. But what we do with anybody at any stage of their career is we work with them to identify what their big dream is, and then we help support and guide them on how to get there. And after working in the company for 2.5 years now and knowing about our client stories that go back all the way 9-10 years from the beginning, the biggest struggle for most people is having that big dream. Most people, what we found, especially those the further along they get in their career, will prevent themselves from even thinking of the thing that will make them happy because they're scared, because society says it doesn't exist, all of these reasons. And so that's where a lot of our work comes in. But once people do identify that, we we'll coach them, guide them on business skills, on networking skills. That's a huge passion of mine. On rebranding, all of these skills that musicians really need to adopt in order to have the careers they want. And through most of our trainings, either those things didn't exist, or as we're seeing for a lot of the upcoming musicians who have just graduated from conservatory, there was this wave after conservatories realized that entrepreneurial skills were necessary, there was this wave of like an emphasis on the do everything, quote unquote, innovative classical musician, like the classical musician who performs at the local bar and at the retirement home and does concerts with media projections. And like, it's a very specific type of entrepreneurial musician. And it's kind of, I don't know, I haven't decided yet what's worse, like no curriculum or a curriculum that only focuses on that, because what you have is a lot of musicians in their mid to late 20s who, when they hear entrepreneurial, they like tense up, almost get angry, and they're like, I do not want to give community concerts. And we're like, whoa, nobody is asking you to. What are you talking about? When in reality, an entrepreneurial musician, you know, as you know, can look like anyone. And I feel so lucky. I have one of my closest friends from undergrad is a Baroque cellist who is also a DJ. She has like a huge Instagram following, and her name is Emily Plays Cello, if a plug is allowed on Instagram.
Nice.
Yeah, she's great. I use her as an example all the time because she's still a Baroque cellist. I mean, Baroque music, you can't really be super innovative with Baroque music if you want to play Baroque music, like Baroque musicians want to play Baroque music. But what she does with her career, with her Patreon page, with teaching lessons virtually before anybody I knew taught lessons virtually, and using her career as a DJ, an electronic musician, to push audiences who wouldn't normally absorb Baroque music towards her Baroque page. Like, that's what we talk about when we talk about an entrepreneurial musician. How can we help musicians identify all of the strengths that they have? And if they're not, if they're feeling like their careers haven't yet reached their most fulfilled place, how can we help them reach that place without it being a, oh, I have to transform into something else that I'm not in order to get there? Because that will never result in fulfillment. Changing who we are doesn't result in fulfillment. You know, being who we are to the best of our abilities does.
Just a last question, because again, unfortunately, we're running out of time. But do you only work with classical musicians, or do you work with musicians of all stripes? Like, tell us about that.
That's a great question. So we work with musicians of all kinds. We actually, you know, one of my clients is a visual artist. We work with arts-minded people. We also do work with arts administrators. We have this one course that we are really pushing right now because we released it about 6 months ago, and the success we've seen within that course has really blown us away. It's this program called Idea to Impact. If you go to www.ikadenza.com and go to group coaching, it's there. And it's a 6-month program for anybody who wants to launch what we call a career milestone project. And that project can be anything. It doesn't have to be a physical project. It can be an initiative. It can be a big goal. But the point is that for anybody who is in the arts, we're all facing the same struggles. And oftentimes we don't look to the other arts avenues to help us with the skills that we think are like totally out of reach that other fields in the arts have conquered. We work with a classical radio station, and something that they have said to us is, you know, people think that classical music is dying, but our classical music radio numbers keep going up and up and up. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to audiences, you know, classical radio, especially in the bigger cities and states, they've got it. And meanwhile, you have arts organizations, symphonies and operas saying our numbers are dwindling, but they're not talking to each other. So this group program, it's a 6-month program, bi-weekly support in a group setting, individual calls with our coaches, content modules. It's like jam-packed with stuff. And what's really cool about it is we have composers, performers, we have classical musicians, we have people who are on the outskirts of it. We, to date, have not had a fully top musician singer-songwriter, but we are not closed off to it. In this program, we haven't had that. We've worked with some individually. And we have nonprofit executives. We have it all. And the sounding board that results is just so, so cool. So yes, we don't only work with classical musicians. We work with anybody in the arts who wants to find their dream career.
That's so great. And you guys have a podcast.
We do. We do. We have a podcast. We interview. It's similar to this, a little different, but we interview people who are doing cool things in the arts. So yeah.
Cool. And that's available on the streaming platforms?
It's available on streaming, and it's also available on our website. And we also have a blog. It's available on our website as well. We just redid our website, so if you can't tell, I'm like super proud of it. Because it took so much work for anybody who has ever done a website redo. Oh my gosh. Yep. Worth it, but awful.
Yep, totally. That's so great. Well, Lisa, again, thank you so much. I think that this is definitely outside of the box in terms of what people think of classical music or classical musicians or that whole world. So I really appreciate you giving us all a new perspective on that.
Thank you so much, El Ariel. And if there's ever anything I or we can do to help you, please let me or us know.
Thank you so much, Lisa. That was fantastic. Always great to hear about a really unique and varied career trajectory, you know, starting out as a classical musician and then going into her dream job. That's what this is all about, that it's never a linear line. So you can find out more about iCadenza on their website, as Lisa said, iCadenza.com. They're also on social media at iCadenza. So make sure you follow them, check out their blog, listen to their podcast, find out all about how they can help you achieve the highest potential that you can achieve. Okay, baby. So thus ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Again, I am your host, El Ariel, and we are on social media at Music Jobs Podcast. We're on Instagram and we're on the Twitter. And me, myself, and I, El Ariel, is also on social media. My website is lariel music.com. That's lariel music.com. Social media is at lariel music. I'd love it if you want to stop by, say hi, maybe check out my music, all that good stuff. So I hope everyone has another wonderful, productive last week of November as we head again into the last month of 2018. Take good care. Keep on hustling. And remember to, wait, what do I say? I say keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.